On a bright March morning in 2022, some 780 men and women were called to an urgent meeting with their managers at P&O Ferries. They're informed through a short video call they were all sacked, with agency staff lined up to take up their roles within hours. For those customers who were sailing from Dover to France that day, they might have noticed little difference. But for those P&O workers and their families, the impact of the decision was devastating. The Johnson government shared public dismay, the Prime Minister declaring that the company would not be allowed to get away with it. They did, reflecting Britain's weak employment laws and even weaker system of enforcement. Around 1 in 10 of us in the UK are now classified as precarious workers, meaning low pay, with their employers accepting the barest minimum of contractual obligations. The question that should be plaguing policymakers is how to protect workers from this fire and rehire practices that P&O utilised in 2022 with so little consequence. Dr. Ella Cobain is an associate professor at UCL's Department of Security and Crime Science, whose most recent work has focused on labour exploitation and also human trafficking and child sexual abuse. She recently received the prestigious Philip Leverhulme Prize, which recognises outstanding researchers. Welcome to the We Society, Dr. Ella Cobain. Great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Will. It's great to be here.
We Society, when you got the call, this curiously entitled podcast, what did you think of this title? What did it impart to you?
I like it. I mean, the more I work in complex social issues, the more you realise that everything is interconnected and that you can't just narrow off one section without thinking about the implications and interactions with a whole range of other policies, with other research, with other people. So, yeah, we're all connected.
I mean, you really do go for it. I mean, you are, I mean, talk about complex social issues, whether it's precariousness in the labour market, child sexual abuse, human trafficking. I mean, you're there. I mean, and some of the work you've done has been trailblazing and been recognised by this prize. There's a lot of detail, a lot of stuff to cover, but just frame the whole thing for us, if you like. I mean, what attracts you to this dark underbelly of British society?
I'm really lucky to lead a research group at UCL called the Research Group on Human Trafficking, Smuggling and Exploitation. And broadly speaking, that sums up the main areas I'm interested in. So labour market abuses might seem completely separate to child sexual abuse, but there's that kind of underlying current of interpersonal exploitation that's there, and also the influences of the systems and structures around us. And trafficking as well, smuggling as well, they all fall, broadly speaking, under that sort of umbrella of complex interpersonal social harms. So those are my interests. How did I get into this? I did an undergrad in modern languages. And then straight out of university, I went to work in advertising. And I did a couple of years on a grad scheme working on a very, very, very large consumer goods company's laundry account. And it was just so phenomenally boring. And I realised having my first publication was a book on laundry demos. And I had to watch hundreds and hundreds of laundry demos and comment on the size of the different bubbles. But at the time, I was also working on a children's charity account, the Bernardo's account, and just found it so much more interesting. And it was around at the time the sort of painting of children, disadvantaged children, as being sort of feral youths. And then, yeah, I left there quite quickly and ended up at UCL and have been working these kind of topics ever since.
And let's kick off with precarious work and that P&O story. Yeah. I mean, just give some sense to listeners of the, in your view, the scale of this problem in the UK. I mean, how it's sometimes called gig work, and some people, of course, say that some people in the labour market quite like gig work, but in the main, it's exploitative. But what's the scale of it?
Nobody really knows. So there are some statistics on how many people have worked in the gig economy, but those are quite outdated now.
I've seen figures of 1 in 10.
Yes. So for precarious work, it really depends how you define it. So we did some initial scoping work led by my colleague, Dr. Chris Posh, estimating the number of people in precarious work. And we came to a very similar figure to what you just said. So it was about 9.7%, so about 1 in 10 people. But there's different ways that work can be precarious. It can be precarious because it's insecure because of the type of work. Maybe you're on a zero-hours contract. It can be precarious because you're juggling multiple jobs. It can be precarious because you're very poorly paid or you work in a small company that maybe are less good around enforcing your labour rights or respecting your labour rights. But what you have is this whole kind of broad spectrum of both things which the government defines as labour market non-compliance, so sort of breaches of certain labour laws, and then other things which my colleague Sam Scott describes as work-based harm. So they're not strictly a breach of labour law, but they intersect and they contribute to this kind of sense of awfulness.
It gets complicated very fast, doesn't it?
I mean, it's,
and we understand zero-hour contracts, so I think people we kind of got that, but workplace harm, you're thinking what just the standards of behaviour that should either be kind of legally there or just understood to be there as a social moray are not being observed.
Yeah, so it's things like sexual harassment at work. That wouldn't constitute
a breach of labour laws. But you include that in your precarious work?
We would count that as work-based harm,
right?
But it's not a form of labour market non-compliance.
Okay.
Ironically,
so it's not in the 1 in 10 figure.
The 1 in 10 figure is the estimated number of people in precarious work.
Okay.
Nobody knows the scale of labour market abuse.
But that's you're going to find out.
We are hopefully going to find out. So, yeah. And ironically, the P&O example you gave, that is actually also not counted as labour market non-compliance. So that would fall as well into workplace harm. So it's that kind of broader tapestry of things, like health and safety issues that contribute to a sense of just things not being very good at work.
Now who's at risk here? I mean, is it young people? Is it uneducated, non-trained older people? Is it across the gamut? I mean, have you any sense of, you know, who's at risk and what is the nature of the risks that they're running?
Both nationally and internationally, there's a growing evidence base suggesting that people in precarious work are most at risk of various forms of labour market abuses because they have less social mobility, less geographical mobility, harder to access justice.
But who are they? Women? Are they children? Are they?
Women are overrepresented. Younger people are overrepresented in precarious work. Certain industries are overrepresented. So things like hospitality, for example, construction. There was some really interesting survey research done by the Resolution Foundation last year, and they found that for various different labour market abuses, the people that were at the sharp end were more likely to be ethnic minorities, more likely to be women, more likely to be either younger or at the older end of the age bracket. I think it's probably all sorts of mechanisms interacting, but it's things like limited alternatives. It's things like a sense of kind of having to put up with poor treatment because
also bad pay.
Poor pay.
And many people don't get payslips. Big problem. So if you don't get a payslip and you're poorly paid, being able even just to get a rental property, let alone borrow money to buy somewhere, it becomes impossible. I mean, you find yourself driven to the margins of society very quickly.
And it's much harder to leave a job that's treating you badly if you don't have a safety net.
And Britain has a very weak safety net. We'll come to that in a minute. I mean, what are the causes of this? I mean, we just don't take it seriously. There's one whole basket of kind of issues around weak law.
Mm-hmm.
There's another whole basket of issues around weak enforcement. There's another basket of issues about the fact that we've allowed trade unions and workplace representations to decline, workplace representation to decline, I should say. And then at the same time, there's a certain kind of rogue capitalism abroad alongside some very good capitalism. Put it all together and you have what we have.
Yeah, so it's a a sort of fragmentation of the labour market, growth of non-traditional work. It's very hard to enforce your rights. I mean, so my colleagues who are labour lawyers, Virginia Montuvalu and Jack Beedsworth, have been doing some scoping for us so that we can make sure that this survey we're doing is legally accurate, right? And it is so complex, the legal landscape. And actually, there's relatively few labour laws that are well enforced by existing enforcement agencies. There's a huge amount of onus on the individual worker to take cases themselves to employment tribunal. And that's stressful. It's difficult. You have to do it very quickly. There's a short qualifying period. And then we have a government that's talking about reintroducing charges for employment tribunal cases, which is absolute madness if you're serious about trying to tackle labour market exploitation. But yeah, I guess I think it's an intersection of factors. If we look at, to give a really tangible example, people who are migrants, right? So under the hostile environment policies, you have the introduction of all these sorts of laws like the so-called illegal working offence. So the minute that you start to kind of block people out of the labour market, and it happens as well in the housing market, it happens as well with driving licences, it happens with access to health, the minute you start to block people out, right, where do you go? You go to employers who are more unscrupulous, who know that you don't have the right to work, and who know that as a result they can get away with underpaying you. So that's some of the reasons, particularly if we're thinking about, say, irregular migration and the kind of sharp end of labour market exploitation.
There's two directions to take this conversation. I mean, one is, I think people want to know now about how you're going to find out about more about this. So we need to know about that. But secondly, I'd like to talk about not just the social consequences of it, but the economic consequences of it. Because I think, you know, I think the more this has grown, I think, and the more substantive an issue it becomes, you can link that to the story about Britain's poor productivity. So there's two, but let's go first with your, this extraordinary piece of work you're about to embark on. I mean, it's like, it's like virgin snow. You know, you're going to be pioneering and giving data that we don't have. One of the most exhaustive studies I think done in any industrial country. I mean, go for it. I mean,
it's really, really exciting. It's a project that is co-funded by the Economic and Social Research Council and the Department for Business and Trade that I'm co-leading with my colleague Chris Posh, who's a statistician, and with an amazing team of other researchers as well. And we're looking at research into the scale and the nature of labour market non-compliance and other forms of work-based harm among people in precarious work in the UK.
So, I mean, so, it's tens of thousands of people. I mean, your survey is huge, isn't it? I mean, the data.
Yeah, it should be really, really good. I mean, it's a representative survey, which we're going to field through Understanding Society, which is the largest household survey in the world. And then on top of that, surveys are brilliant, right, for understanding prevalence and understanding the kind of correlates and the distribution of things. But this is a really nice example as well of a mixed method study that's kind of really integrated from the start, because what they're not so good for surveys is getting into the depth and the nuance of the issues people are encountering. So that's why we're going to follow that up with in-depth interviews with people in precarious work and also focus groups with them to try and understand actually what would help. You know, how do they think the systems need to change? You said it was pioneering. We think it's super exciting, but we should also acknowledge there's brilliant, brilliant work that's been done in the UK and internationally that we are very much building on. And we've been really lucky with this project to have the most amazing teams of advisors that includes, you know, academics that have done pioneering work in the States, in Canada, other places internationally.
How long will it take? 2 years?
We're hoping to have initial findings by the end of this year and full report next year.
So that's good. That's good going. We're going to discover in the public domain and in the hands of policymakers will be kind of issues that require a redress. Now, I would say this immediately gets you into the question of enforcement, and it also what the law currently is, let alone tightening it. And secondly, it opens up the debate about if you can get away with this in the labour market, it tends to have an impact on productivity levels, actually. So it's an urgent question. Give us your reflections.
So we're really, really lucky that this project has been commissioned by the Director for Labour Market Enforcement. And successive directors have been really, really interested in actually gathering this evidence and finding out about what sort of scale labour market non-compliance is happening on, how it concentrates, who's most at risk. Because that, like you said, it has huge implications for responses.
I mean, just to give listeners some sense of this, between 2017 and 2022, over a five-year period, there are only four cases of the law being enforced. I mean, I find that stat just extraordinary.
Or you look at something like holiday pay, and there's no agency that's responsible for enforcing holiday pay. And there's all sorts of things like, you know, underpayment of wages, the maximum possible restoration is double, isn't it? The amount you weren't paid. So given that the chances of getting caught are so low and the penalties are also low, it's these kinds of things can become things that unscrupulous employers factor into the cost of doing business and just take that risk and don't treat their work as well.
The underbelly of British society is really, you know, I mean, it's Victorian, it's Dickensian, and it's going, you know, it's in plain sight.
Yeah, I mean, you look at things like the delivery workers' strikes. On Valentine's Day, delivery workers and other workers did a kind of wildcat strike, walking out because pay and conditions have degraded so much, but because they are not officially recognised as workers in labour law, they don't have entitlements to sick pay. They don't have entitlements to national minimum wage.
Or holiday pay.
Or holiday pay.
Or holidays.
Exactly. And the same happens. I mean, got colleagues working on issues around domestic work. For the first time this spring, something called the domestic family worker exemption is due to be abolished. But before that, you could employ someone in your home and not pay them national minimum wage. And that's led to huge amounts of exploitation within an area that's kind of devalued, hidden, feminized labour. But despite, you know, the change, which is great, around the wage exemption, domestic workers don't have the right to maximum hours protections either under European law. In theory, you can't make someone work more than 48 hours a week on average. But that doesn't apply to domestic workers. And also for other workers, some of the challenges we're hearing through the groups we've been running are stuff like it's actually really easy to push people to opt out of it. So you can just put a little term in the contract and then someone says, okay, fine. But if you're, you know, if you're offering someone a job and you're making it contingent on them saying, okay, fine, I don't mind exceeding that maximum number of hours, it's very easy to see how things can get very exploitative very quickly.
Just before we round this off, three or four sentences. What should be done?
Unions. Because we're so much stronger together. And I say that, you know, I work in universities. Universities are notoriously precarious. Obviously, many of us, particularly in academic positions, are nowhere near in as bad a position as other people in the labour market. But we've still seen an erosion of pay, of pensions, and that kind of coming together and fighting back for our rights really helps. So I think unions are really important. I think labour market enforcement is really important. But we have to learn a lesson here from what we've seen around policing and immigration enforcement. And we need to make sure that labour market enforcement is not in cahoots with immigration enforcement. Because otherwise, you know, if you're doing more inspections or what have you in workplaces, but you're coming in with immigration enforcement or people fear that their data, their personal data might be passed on, then that just creates a climate of fear where it's too dangerous for people to disclose.
Professor Alan Bogg at the University of Bristol, I mean, he argues that in cases like P&O, if the company is cocking a snook at labour law, the laws inhibiting trade union action should be suspended too. And so the union should have the freedom to kind of secondary picket and really really hold the kind of offending company to account for their... What do you think of that as an idea?
Alan Bogg is brilliant. I mean, he's pretty much the country's leading expert on trade unions and trade union law. So I would very much defer to his expertise on that. That sounds very sensible to me. But there also needs to be stronger laws protecting people's rights. there is a single enforcement body that has been long promised and has not
and never got off the ground.
No.
We've been waiting for 4 years. Mm-hmm. It's absurd.
Exactly. So, you know, bringing everything together in a way that it's not so complicated for workers. This idea that, you know, one thing's been breached, you go there, one thing's been breached, you go there, but you have to go there first. And how are you meant to navigate that? It was confusing.
If you enjoy the We Society podcast, you may also enjoy The Slow Newscast from Tortoise Media. The Slow Newscast is an investigative podcast that aims to tell a fresh, exciting story each week by focusing on the stories that really matter in the UK and around the world. From the war in Ukraine, the downfall of Boris Johnson, to true crime and injustice and real-life mysteries, the Slow Newscast team is devoted to narrative investigations. From a startup newsroom with a different approach to journalism, The Slow Newscast offers a more in-depth take on a single story than the flurry of daily news. There'll be fresh investigations looking at everything from extreme sports to corruption and assassinations. So if you want to slow down, look up The Slow Newscast wherever you get your podcasts. Let's change, go to another area. This kind of underbelly of British life, child sexual exploitation. I mean, how big an issue is this? And how many kids suffer?
So child sexual abuse happens on an absolutely epidemic scale.
Epidemic scale? Mm-hmm. That's a big statement, Ella.
Yeah, I stand by that. That was also the conclusion of the independent inquiry into child sexual abuse that ran for years and years and looked at child sexual abuse over a whole variety of institutional contexts. So the best available data that we have is an estimated at least 1 in 7 girls and at least 1 in 20 boys are sexually abused as children. The Centre of Expertise on Child Sexual Abuse estimates that around 500,000 children are sexually abused in this country every year. I mean, huge, huge scale. Yeah. And only a fraction of it comes up in the official statistics. And again, this is an area where a up-to-date, robust prevalence study is long overdue.
Although, is one planned?
Yes, as I understand it.
And will you be involved or would you?
No, I'm not involved.
You've got enough
that,
on your plate. But this is an area where you have done some work.
Yeah.
I mean, your passion comes, in this small studio, your passion really comes across when you talk about this. I mean, what are your reflections on this? I mean, what's driving it? And why are adults doing this to kids at such scale? I mean, what's going on in our society that permits this to happen?
Honestly, it happens everywhere. It's not just the UK. It's studies have found remarkably similar levels in across all sorts of different countries and contexts. I think people are often not very nice. People do awful things. It's very heavily gendered, so the vast majority of offenders are male. There's questions around power, there's questions around access, there's questions around culture, there's questions around, situational vulnerabilities and situational harms. So, particular contexts in which it's very easy to get access to children or to put pressure on them not to disclose. There's questions around poor responses. I mean, that's come out over and over again over the years. You know, children not being listened to, children not being taken seriously, not being believed, and particularly when it's children who are marginalised and often marginalised in multiple ways, it kind of being seen as their fault, victim blaming. But again, that's not unique to child sexual abuse. We have the same problems with sexual violence in general.
I mean, the kind of popular narrative is that there's a lot of grooming. It's not just within a family or within a kinship network. It's actually there are gangs grooming kids for sexual pleasure of adults. I mean, how much of an issue is that in your view?
So there have been very real, horrendous cases that have been all over the news. And absolutely, these are real. They're awful and they've had huge harms. At the same time, It's very easy to forget that the vast majority of child sexual abuse occurs within the home or by someone who's already close to a child. There's growing dangers online. And what we've had in this country is this kind of cynical construction of a very deliberate, very narrow and short-sighted threat narrative that positions child sexual abuse or child sexual exploitation as this kind of problem of so-called Muslim grooming gangs. Which, again, is not to say that there have not been cases that meet these stereotypes.
Yeah, they are.
But when you zero in that way and you ignore everything else we know about child sexual abuse, which is that it's a, you know, on an enormous scale, it affects boys as well as girls.
You find it in Boy Scouts, you find it in football, you find it in the church. I mean, you know, it's not.
But this has been constructed by the British media and then kind of spread and endorsed from politicians from the very top, despite their own government's evidence that undermines it. Because it's politically useful and it detracts from all sorts of failings in child protection that have been hugely exacerbated by austerity policies. And it's much easier to, you know, make it a problem of, oh, it's those, you know, nasty outsiders, rather than facing up to the fact that this is a problem everywhere and it needs really, really serious steps to change responses.
I mean, child protection is... in part, and sometimes wholly, the responsibility of local government, isn't it? And local government is on its knees, as we know. And there are kind of 8 local governments have kind of had to declare themselves bankrupt and are being kind of run by commissioners. And another 1 in 5 are going to go that way next year, it is said, or in the next 2 years. So a casualty of kind of starving local government of finance is... weaken child protection. Do you have any scale? Can we get any sense of the scale of this, of the numbers? Have you got any insight into it?
Of
the degree to which child protection has been kind of hindered or hurt by kind of cutbacks and austerity?
I'm afraid I don't have the numbers off the top of my head. What I would say is, again, this is a complex systems issue. So absolutely, local government, child safeguarding, huge part to play. There's also a lot that is done in this area by civil society. And again, it's charities have been hit very hard, particularly kind of small local grassroots charities that do incredibly important work and struggle to get funding for it. So I think that's a big part of the problem as well. There's very little in the way of investment in prevention and early intervention, which is madness. Because, you know, criminal justice responses are important. They're important symbolically. They're important for criminal justice to specific victims who want that. But they come after the harm is done. And we know as well that things like waiting times within the Crown Prosecution Service, if your case to go to trial, if it even goes to trial, you know, it can be years and years. So people just stuck in limbo. And all that's after the harm's done. Whereas if you actually kind of invest in getting in there
sooner. So what would a preventative system look like then?
It would look like actually thinking about how do you identify these things quicker? How do you design systems and structures to make it harder to abuse children? How do you make it easier for people to disclose? So things like, simple things, like if we think about situational prevention, right, which is kind of the environmental context in which, the immediate environment in which crimes occur. It's stuff like not having closed door policies in school where a single teacher is in a room with a child by themselves, or, you know, ensuring 2 people go in at once, or thinking about stuff like contextual safeguarding, which is a really exciting area of child protection and social work that looks rather than at children and individual risk factors, looks at their kind of social context and their spatial context and what can be done.
I'm trying to understand these words.
Am I not making sense?
No. I know. I mean, I kind of understand it at a kind of helicopter level, but when you talk to me, you know, social context, spatial context, I mean, what concretely, what does that mean?
So rather than it being all about an individual child, right, and individual risk factors, are they connected up to lots of other children who are also being abused or also at risk of abuse? Are there particular locations where the abuse is concentrated?
Right, thinking
of it in a much more interconnected way,
right,
and then thinking within that, what are the levers you can pull? What are the interventions you can put in place? So really being a lot more targeted around prevention, because there is a role for, you know, so in public health terms, you talk about primary, secondary and tertiary interventions, right? So primary is your kind of big, broad general population type stuff to improve health and well-being. So that might be things like awareness raising around child sexual abuse. Secondary is when you get more into sort of high-risk populations. And tertiary is your, in the context of child sexual abuse, it's your sort of intervening once someone's already very high risk or already being abused to try and stop the abuse continuing and trying to support them and provide things to meet their needs. But this requires, it requires good evidence, and it requires disaggregating issues that can be enormously varied.
It also requires a national conversation about it. It requires being given some foregrounding as an issue that requires this kind of mobilization. I mean, that, you know, when you tell me that 500,000 kids are suffering, I'm thinking to myself, got to raise the salience of this. But lastly, human trafficking, that's another area that, I mean, you, a conversation with you is a kind of, we move from, you know, but we move from what's going on in the labour market to what's going on with child sexual abuse to human trafficking. Again, scale?
Nobody knows. There are estimates, but the estimates are mostly pretty terrible. They're generally based on wild extrapolations based on a very small number of identified cases, or they're based on so-called indicators that are often of highly questionable empirical value. We know in the UK about people who've been identified by the authorities as victims of trafficking or suspected victims of trafficking. So, for example, between 2009 and 2019, that was about 26,500 people we found in our research. But again, that's the tip of the iceberg. And also because a lot of people have good reason for not engaging with the state.
When we talk about trafficking, we're talking about people who literally are kind of under the radar, working in bonded labour or semi-slave conditions.
I think that's part of the problem with the whole narrative around trafficking. Trafficking is exploitation, right? It can be sexual exploitation. It can be labour exploitation in all sorts of different forms. It can be things like organ harvesting, although we have very, very few documented cases of that in the UK so far. But the term makes it sound bigger and scarier and more extreme, and it is awful. It can be very extreme, but it's relatively rare that it will sort of meet the stereotypes of someone being physically confined or, you know, tied up, or those kind of really sort of evocative immediate associations people often have. And in many ways, it's better understood as being the kind of sharp end on a dynamic spectrum of labour exploitation or a spectrum of sexual exploitation.
Well, look,
if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. And I mean, just round that off, I mean, because we're reaching the end of the discussion. I mean, labour market, child sexual exploitation, what kind of, in terms of policy salience and policy action and concern for our listeners, you know, how would you evaluate human trafficking?
In terms of trafficking and improving responses, I think some of the most important things that could be done here would be dismantling the hostile environment, because migration laws and policies and hostile environment policies make it much, much easier to exploit people and much, much harder to seek help from the state.
So part of this kind of anti-immigration kind of
And, you know, things
drive.
Like the Rwanda scheme. If people think they're going to risk being shipped off to Rwanda, why would you come forward, even if you're being exploited in very, very extreme conditions? So that's one issue. Another thing that I think would be hugely important here is decriminalisation of sex work. So there is a very, very strong evidence base that sex workers are better able to exercise their rights and are safer and better protected under decriminalisation. And it would help stop anti-trafficking being used as a smokescreen for enforcement against sex workers, which sadly happens all too often. And there is a growing evidence base of even well-intentioned anti-trafficking interventions causing really significant collateral damage.
Just before we wind this up, I mean, we've covered some extraordinary ground in this conversation. And these are all issues which are, you know, toxic. And not only do you research in them and you bring data into the public domain, so you're a public-facing social scientist. Any reflections on that? How do you deal with the reactions to some of the things that you're saying?
As social scientists, I think we have a responsibility to engage in public debate. In some ways, I guess I've been more exposed than most people to how toxic it can get, particularly because of my work challenging, you know, racial stereotypes around so-called grooming gangs. And it is draining. It can be really terrifying and exhausting at times. And I think there's a conversation for universities as institutions to have about how they better protect and support researchers that are working in enormously contentious areas. But yeah, I think it's important. Otherwise, if you're just doing research and you're not using it to try and inform public debate and try and encourage change, it feels like a bit of a waste, I think.
Well, the We Society is supported by the Academy of Social Sciences. We try to bring social science of the type that you do and social scientists, we try to kind of bring them into the public kind of arena, and you've certainly done that today. I mean, and the quality of your research, the kind of care with which you speak about these tricky issues, the fact you've won the Leverhulme Prize is kind of, I can see why they gave you the prize.
I'm very grateful for it. And, thanks, Leverhulme.
And I mean, and whether it's, you know, your insights into child sex abuse and what might be done to reduce it, how to promote, kind of make the case for stronger trade unions and better labour market enforcement. I found it a riveting conversation. I'm sure our listeners will agree. So thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, who can be found at acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. Have any suggestions for guests, feedback for the programme? Email us on wesociety@acss.org.uk. And above all, thank you for listening.